Well, good morning. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us for our March Ag Sector Council seminar, which has a great title, I think. Fertilizer Subsidies in Sub-Saharan Africa, Smart Policy or Political Trap? So we're very excited to have these two distinguished speakers with us today. But before we get started, just a couple of housekeeping issues. First, we always like to remind people to please silence your cell phones, just so that we don't interrupt the speakers, if you've brought those along. Second, this webinar is being recorded, and we also have a large webinar audience. Our team in the back of the room is bringing in the webinar group. And so for both of those reasons, we generally ask that you hold your questions until the end, and also that you use one of these microphones that we'll pass around to make sure that we get it recorded and that the webinar audience can hear you. I just wanted to mention that so this is a product of the Ag Sector Council seminar series, which actually just passed its sixth anniversary. We've been holding seminars like this for about 6 years and been doing them in webinar format for almost 4 years now, which has been really exciting. We've had just a great lineup of speakers, and Tom's actually been a part of an AgriLinks seminar in the past, so we're excited to have return speakers as well. And it's really grown and changed over the years. It's a product of the USAID Bureau for Food Security, but it started with the old Office of Agriculture and the AgriLinks platform. So if any of you ever have questions about knowledge sharing for Feed the Future and the Bureau for Food Security, or just the AgriLinks platform in general, you're welcome to get in touch with me, Julie McCarty. I'm a Knowledge Management Specialist with BFS. And I just wanted to mention that our April event coming up next month will be on the role of agricultural insurance in promoting resilience and inclusive growth. That should be a really interesting event, and it will be in partnership with our sister site, MicroLinks, which is another USAID knowledge sharing platform. All right, so to introduce our speakers today and to just give a couple of words of introduction, I would like to introduce Margaret Spears, who is the director of the Office of Market and Partnership Innovations at the USAID Bureau for Food Security. So I'll pass the mic briefly over to Margaret.
Well, welcome, and thank you for participating in this important discussion about input subsidies today. Increasing use of fertilizer and other improved inputs is an important aim of Feed the Future and is also key to increasing productivity to the levels needed to feed a growing population. So current use of fertilizers in Africa and other improved inputs in Africa lags far behind other parts of the world. And increasing that is an important part of reaching the agricultural potential for Africa. In my office, we're particularly interested in how to encourage this in a sustainable way that doesn't distort markets or discourage private sector participation in the input markets. This is very important for implementation of the Feed the Future programs, but also for the policy support and dialogue that we have within the countries where we work. I'm particularly excited about this session, which will examine evidence across countries as well as within one country on the effectiveness of different policies used to encourage increased fertilizer use. And I'm happy to introduce our speakers today. We have Michael Carter. He's a professor of Ag and Resource Economics at the University of California at Davis, and he also directs the Basis Access Markets and Market Access Innovation Lab in the I4 Indexed Insurance Innovation Initiative. And these are very important tools and for our thinking on risk, insurance, and related programs there. And then also introduce Thomas Jane, who's a University Foundation Professor of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. He's also a visiting professor at the University of Pretoria and adjunct professor at the Indaba Agriculture Policy Research Institute in Lusaka, Zambia. And he's also been an instrumental partner in our thinking about policies on agriculture. They have a great set of presentations lined up and are certain to stimulate some lively discussion. So I'll turn the microphone back to Julie so we can really get started. And thank you so much for your participation and for your presentations today.
Thank you very much, Margaret. All right, we can turn it over to our speakers.
Good. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. This is an issue that's both important and interesting. A couple of you were laughing at the funny picture of me. I was actually adjusting my glasses so if I could see if Tom was coming up behind me to whack me over the head on this one. So this is joint work with Dean Yang, who's at University of Michigan, and Rashid Laja, who's at the Paris School of Economics. The work itself is also collaborative with the International Fertilizer Development Center, who in some sense have a dog in this fight, but we'll get into that as we go along. So Margaret already alluded to the stylized fact that I think all of us in this room are aware of, that use of inorganic fertilizers across sub-Saharan Africa is very, very low. When we got interested in, I'd read Tom's work over the years, that fertilizer subsidies were often, if particularly done poorly, were a really bad idea, but we were really interested in seeing if we could actually find an opportunity to really nail down what are the impacts of fertilizer subsidies. And we had an opportunity in Mozambique, which we developed with the IFDC. And by their kind of farmer field trials, they were saying, look, every year farmers are leaving 2 to 3 tons per hectare potential production behind that they could receive if they just used improved seeds and fertilizers. And yet, in our sample, for example, roughly 10% of the farmers only had ever used any kind of inorganic fertilizers. And many of those were farmers who had actually worked in Zimbabwe on larger scale farms. And so it was sort of a really good opportunity. So we said, okay, well, here's a chance. Unlike Malawi or some of the countries that have made fertilizer subsidies almost a constitutional right, we said, here's a chance to get in and look at a small-scale program and see how might it be done. So as a starting point here, I've just listed a few possible explanations. I mean, why is this a problem? Why might the rate of fertilizer use, why might farmers be leaving 2 tons per hectare of maize on the table every year that they're not achieving, given that the technology is already there? And one kind of explanation, it's one Tom's going to delve into in more detail later, is I call it here a technological explanation, is that they don't do it because it's not profitable, basically. The soil structures are not there. The actual returns to fertilizer are not there. And there's some implications. Again, I'll leave that for Tom to talk about. I'm going to skip down here to sort of behavioral explanations as well. There was some work done a few years ago that said, well, actually it is profitable, but people just have trouble saving money. They think they're going to do it, and then, an opportunity for some better use of the money comes up, and they never quite get there. And so it just takes the so-called behavioral nudge to get people there. That's another kind of explanation. What I'd like to focus on here today, I'm going to call them sort of core economic explanations. Could be that farmers are simply, they're so poor, they're sort of caught, their liquidity constrained. Another kind of economic problem might be an informational problem. They don't really know what the returns to fertilizers are. So if 90% of farmers in a region have never really used those fertilizers, maybe they don't really know. So that's what we're going to focus on here, is might you then do subsidies, for, input subsidy programs, might that actually be a way to get people to learn, maybe to get them a little extra money, because if the inputs are subsidized, they make a lot of money the first year, and then if they can carry that forward in time. There might also be a complementarity with various kinds of financial interventions as well. As some of you know, and as Margaret mentioned, I run something called the I4 Index Insurance Innovation Initiative. I have more programs going on insurance than I care to mention. But again, we're finding evidence in those programs that if you pull risk out of a system, farmers may actually find the money that they need to make these kinds of investments, and risk may be the inhibiting factor. So we'll come back to some of that in a moment. And finally, again, I'm not going to talk about it here, but be happy to do so. There actually are hybrid explanations. So the drought-tolerant maize project, for example, is sort of a hybrid explanation in saying the technologies that are there are just too risky. So if you can get a technology like drought-tolerant maize that pulls risk out of the system, then maybe that will relax that constraint and things might move forward. And then there's more exotic explanations about where do our aspirations, hopes, and preferences come from, and that may be part of the story as well. But let's jump right in and think a little bit more about these economic explanations. And the first question I want to mention is, if we think about this carefully and we think there might be a case for input subsidies, is that an argument for those subsidies being permanent or an argument for them being temporary? And I want to argue that at least the thinking that I can come up with, the argument should be that they should be a temporary kind of thing. As Tom will give some figures in a moment, the problem, if it is a problem, the reality is that a number of countries have made fertilizer subsidies a permanent feature of the political economic landscape. But if we, as he'll mention, that's a big problem because the opportunity cost of those funds can be quite high. So why are we doing this? Why are we spending so much money on this? I gave a talk in Ghana last year talking about some of this work, mostly macro finance ministry kind of people, and they thought they were going to go to sleep during a session on an agricultural topic. And then when I showed them fractions, I actually used one of Tom's pictures, the fraction of budgets being spent on fertilizer input subsidies, and they all woke up and they say, oh, you mean we don't have to do that? And so the macro guys suddenly were at least momentarily interested in the topic. So I would argue that, at least in the abstract, that subsidies can potentially be really smart policy if they break and relax a number of kind of constraints, and I've listed them on the slide here. So, for example, if they simply relax liquidity constraints for farmers that are really poor, if they sort of jumpstart the system, then that might be a good thing. But again, it's jumpstart. It's a potentially temporary subsidy. Also, if you have a group of farmers who've never really used these inputs, you're asking them to experiment. And if you ask them to experiment on their own dime, the rate of experimentation may be much lower than if you share that risk of experimentation. And finally, anytime you have something like experimentation, which really generates a public good. So if Tom experiments with fertilizers, I can see what he does, and he would rather I take the risk and experiment. If we both wait for each other to experiment, then things are much slower changing than they might be. So again, maybe a temporary subsidy might be a way to sort of break that logjam by reducing the costs of experimentation. So these, to me, are sort of reasonable arguments for why an input subsidy program might make sense. Again, there's a whole literature on how you might do this. And let me just mention, because I'm not going to say anything more about it here today, but this program we're going to look at in Mozambique sat on top of an input market development scheme called, I think it was called the AIMS program, which USAID funded. And these were voucher coupons, and so they weren't trying to replace the private sector. It was actually done on top of a program meant to expand the supply side of the sector. And then this voucher program comes along and sort of hits at the demand side for improved inputs. But you can do fertilizer subsidies other way. The government can just import it and sell it, and then there's another whole set of issues, obviously, surrounding that. But I'm going to step aside from that here. So the question I really want to focus then is this bottom point on the slide. So if there is, in the abstract at least, an argument for temporary subsidies, will they actually work? And to examine that, we had the opportunity then, as I've already alluded to go to Mozambique, where the European Community, in collaboration with the FAO and IFDC, launched a temporary voucher subsidy experiment program. And they had enough money overall in the program to give subsidies, I believe, to 25,000 farmers in the whole country. So in a sense, it's massively oversubscribed. We're going to focus on Manica province in the central part of Mozambique. It's a maize-growing area. And we're going to look at that. And because it was such a small-scale program, there was only money for 2 years. There was an explicit sunset. You know, we're going to do this for 2 years and that's it, we leave. We said, well, this is actually what we want to do. So it gives us a chance to do a proper randomized controlled trial because the amount of resources available were small. And because the program was also small, there was an explicit sunset on the program. So for us, this was an extremely exciting opportunity. The way the program worked is farmers were, we had a lottery of the eligible people in each community. Those that won the lottery got the right for a voucher coupon, which they could take to a local shop. And the voucher coupon would pay roughly three-quarters the price of what were considered to be high-quality inputs for roughly a half hectare of maize. So the subsidy was worth about $80, and the overall package was about $115, something like that. But there was a co-payment required. So that's the basic structure. Let me just jump to this slide. So how did we set this up? The main part of our trial, and what I will largely but not exclusively focus on today, is on the left side of this diagram. So we got a number of communities in Manica province, and we set aside 41 of them where we were just going to do a voucher-only treatment. So we went to these 41 villages, and then within those villages, the community, along with the extension workers for those communities, identified the eligible population, and then we held a lottery amongst those people, with half the people winning of the eligible people in each village winning the lottery, half not winning the lottery. And the winners then were given the right to pick up a voucher coupon. Later on, I'll come back very briefly to the things that are slightly grayed out on the right side of the community. In addition to that, we wanted to do some complementary financial interventions. And so we had another set of basically 30 communities where we implemented what we called a basic savings program. I'll say a bit more about that. And another one where we also implemented a match savings program. And then within each of those communities, we also held the lottery, and there were voucher winners and voucher losers. Okay, I mentioned this at this time because notice winning the voucher is an individual level phenomena. So that means in any community or village, there are going to be some voucher winners and some voucher losers. And we're going to see, in fact, that voucher winners generate information that spills over and seems to affect the behavior with a year lag of voucher losers. However, notice by structure here, people that might be subsidized or encouraged, say with a match savings program, to use formal financial instruments as a new kind of technology, they're actually geographically insulated from the people that only got the vouchers because they were in different communities. So we're going to argue, and this will be important to interpretation later on, that we have some spillovers from voucher winners to voucher losers, but we don't have spillovers from people that got the opportunity to learn about financial technologies. And again, we did that because this was in a mobile banking, old-fashioned mobile banking. Opportunity Bank drove a big armored truck to the villages where the savings were being implemented, and you couldn't sort of exclude anyone from that. Okay, so let me just jump right ahead here to a couple of things. I mean, one thing that's important, I think, to reflect on in terms of the effectiveness of this program is we found that just under half the people that won the voucher lottery actually picked up and used the vouchers, which kind of surprised us because it seemed like it was a pretty good deal, right? A 75% subsidy on this. But in the end, that's part of the reality, and that's part of what makes it difficult. Now, from an impact evaluation perspective, to use sort of fancy language here, this gives us an opportunity to think about the impacts of those people who were offered the program or the impacts only on those people who chose to use the program. And if you're thinking about sort of how effective is a public policy, the answers to those questions are somewhat different. So it's only half the people who were offered the program actually utilized it. I'm going to focus on the impacts of those who actually participated in the program, or what's called the treatment on the treated, because the big money here, besides the administrative costs, the big money here is actually paying for the voucher coupons. So in a sense, that's what we're going to focus on here. But if anyone's more interested in the difference, we can sort of talk about that. Okay. So what did we do? There's obviously lots of torturous academic papers, and we're being tortured by nasty referees as we go through the sort of usual peer review process. So let me just focus on the main kind of outcome variables that we look at. And I've grouped them here into two types, agronomic variables and also economic variables. So we have a bunch of stuff on both maize-specific outcomes, so we can look at impacts of the vouchers on fertilizer use, on maize productivity, maize yields, the usual kind of stuff. And then also, in a sense, more interestingly, I think we look at total agricultural production. Because you might say, well, do you just people just substituting from something else into maize, et cetera. And then finally, and I think to me most interestingly, especially for Feed the Future, we actually put a lot of effort into measuring what I would call kind of core economic outcomes. So if we're interested in food security or food insecurity, we don't really care about kilotons of maize. We actually care about families and their level of well-being. So we use standard measurement survey techniques to actually measure per capita expenditures in these households. And finally, we also look at the accumulation of total household assets over time. And then the final realm in which we look at stuff is then we also are able to say something about what the returns of the fertilizer are, and then also how learning operated in the function of this experiment. So let me jump in and use this first picture to explain the overall structure. So the subsidy period was actually in here. The first subsidy year, we re-randomized after the first year. The first subsidy year was actually a complete disaster. As I mentioned, I work a lot on agricultural insurance. Yields that first year were 40% of normal. I'm sure people that got the subsidies regretted the day anybody ever darkened their door and induced them to spend $30 on something, fertilizer that wasn't going to work. And then we came back and kind of re-randomized the next year. So there's going to be one period where we look at subsidies, and then we continue the study for 2 years afterwards. Okay, and this is what's really interesting is those, you know, the subsidy goes away, prices go back to the usual market level, and what we're interested in is, does this sort of temporary subsidy stick, right? Does it actually look at what happens? So here's a first picture actually looking at kgs per hectare of fertilizer. And so you can see initially at baseline, treatment group is the dark line, solid line here, and the control group, people that didn't win the vouchers, are this lower line. And there are very low levels of fertilizer on average in the samples, just over 10 kg per hectare. Jumps up in the subsidy period. And then what I'd like you to kind of focus on these diamonds, which is the average across the two post-treatment years. But I've shown you both years because there is some indication here of a downward trend. Okay, but certainly if we focus on the diamonds, we can see the subsidies had a huge impact initially, and actually most of that impact seems to stick. If we look at maize yields, we see a similar kind of pattern, again with the average here, I forgot the diamond there, that's my mistake, the average still being substantially above, going from under a ton per hectare to over a ton and a half per hectare. So not quite as much maybe as IFDC might have hoped, but that's what we're seeing. Okay. If we look at total agricultural production, and again, I think this is the more interesting metric from a productivity perspective, then what you see is actually, you know, I think there's actually some reallocation going on as farmers. Actually, if we look at total fertilizer used, it's actually a much more stable relationship. So people are using more fertilizer, not just on maize following this subsidy period, but on other crops as well. So again, we see a pattern, a similar pattern here of the impacts of this program sticking and having made a difference, you know, into the future. Now, if we look at the more, what I think of as the more stringent test, is okay. It looks like we bumped use of inputs in a way that sustained itself after the subsidy expired. There was no longer a subsidy, and people had to pay the full market price of these goods. Does this actually influence people's level of consumption? So here we have our LSMS per capita expenditures kind of number, and you can see baseline they're pretty much the same. At the first subsidy period, nobody's realized the harvest yet, given the timing of the survey. So the surveys were right before harvest. So there's no difference there. And then you start getting a jump. And again, it's a jump of about, this difference here is about a 10% or so, 10 to 15% increase in per capita living standards that seems to persist. So for us, that was pretty remarkable that you could come in, do this small thing. You know, the story kind of fits together if you put the dollars and cents together that we, again, it seems to stick. And similarly, if you look at assets here, you get a similar kind of perspective. Again, I've written a lot of stuff on asset-based approaches to poverty. In some ways, they might be thought to be a more reliable measure, certainly a less noisy measure than expenditures. And you actually get a slightly stronger picture that you begin to get a substantial increase, a substantial difference between the two. And again, these diamond differences that I'm showing you are all statistically significant in the normal sense. So the question is, what explains this? When my colleague Rashid first presented this work before a particularly cranky academic audience, they said, I refuse to believe this. You're telling me that after the subsidy period, the farmer's perspective, prices tripled and they kept doing that? That doesn't make sense to me. And they weren't doing it before. How could that possibly make sense? Well, the way it could possibly make sense is if farmers actually learned something pretty substantial. So one of the things we did in this study was spend a lot of time trying to elicit before and after farmers' beliefs in the returns to fertilizer. And quickly, the way we did it is we let them define bad years, good normal years, and good years, and they gave us the probabilities they attached to their definitions of those. And then we asked them, what do you think the returns are to your normal technology, and what would be the returns you would anticipate to using a kind of an improved input package? Okay, and then from that we can calculate sort of what farmers perceive as the expected gains to fertilizer. So we go through that kind of exercise, and what we actually find is that the voucher recipients' expectations radically change from the program. So if we compare them after the treatment, compared to the control group, they expect 50% higher returns to fertilizer than do non-treated farmers who didn't win the vouchers. If we actually go back to the baseline, it's a 71% increase. And I think that difference arguably is some modified learning that took place for the control group farmers. So our point here is that, they did continue to use it because they actually learned something pretty substantial and significant.
Did the learning reflect the actual?
Yeah. So in fact, they're learning. So we actually use this experiment as a way to estimate the returns to fertilizer. So we have a good statistical setup to do that. And actually, farmers' increase in expectations, they're still pessimistic. okay, based on their actual data. So they are at about 75 to 80. Their expectations after the treatment is about downwardly biased by roughly 20%. So in a sense, the story fits together. So farmers were sort of conservatively, you know, ingesting, if you will, the information from their own experience. Okay, so that's to us is also interesting. So they were very pessimistic before. They weren't expecting very large returns. And the returns we get, and this has helped set up part of what Tom's going to talk about, when we estimate the returns to fertilizers, each kg per hectare gives 20 to 25 kg per hectare of maize. Okay, so that's sort of 20 to 25 to 1 ratio. Farmers are expecting more like 17, 16, something like that. Okay. So, there's that next slide. Okay, so Jerry's question took me right to that point. So in that sense, we think the story sort of fits together. And the final thing I want to talk about then are sort of money matters, as I've labeled this on the slide, is what about some complementarities here? So when we started this program off, we said, well, you know, farmers are going to transition from voucher subsidized finance to self-finance because there's not credit particularly available for these farmers. You know, they need a mechanism to do that. They need an improved technology. And so that's where the mobile banking came in. And so when we set it up, we anticipated that that maybe only farmers that actually had access to improved savings technologies would be able to carry forward the program. Now, there's another thing that improved saving technologies can allow you to do. So in other words, a savings technology makes it cheaper for you to take money today and move it till tomorrow. And tomorrow could be the moment where you want to buy fertilizer, but tomorrow could also be the moment after the next harvest when things have gone bad. Okay, so an improved savings technology may also have, it also cheapens the price of self-insurance, if you will, through savings. Okay, so both of these things could potentially be operative. So let me skip over in the interest of time the details of what we did. But here's what we see. So if we look at, so we have different groups here. We've got the pure control group. And then here we've got the voucher subsidy group, and that's what we've been looking on. This is sort of the impact of the vouchers by themselves on living standards compared to the control group. And then if we look at the other combinations, which are savings alone plus savings and combinations, we actually find very similar levels with one exception across all of them in terms of impacts on living standards, including the households that were just being given the savings groups. The other thing we find, which is really interesting, we have a crude measure. This is work in progress, but I'm confident enough in it to share it. We actually find that if you look at, here's the measure of consumption variability for the control group, and here's the people that only got the voucher. Consumption variability goes up, right? They're using a riskier technology that doesn't always work out, as we've described. And then when you look at the groups that, and look down here at the group that had the subsidy, the voucher subsidy plus match savings, which was a way to really try to encourage them into the financial technology, you find they get both a 9% increase in living standards, but they do so at no increase, no cost in terms of increased variability. So we find this very, very interesting, and it's sort of given us a little pause as a research group to sort of think about it. It seems like the savings treatment is not so much making it possible for people to continue to adopt it, but it makes it possible for them to continue to adopt it without leading to a radical increase in the variability of their production. So so I think that sort of fits together in a very interesting way. So again, we're still working on this just a little bit, but I think as we as a research group are sort of stepping back on this, we were somewhat surprised by this result. We thought we'd see a strong liquidity effect. What we actually seem to be seeing is a much stronger, that what formal savings are doing is actually allowing people to self-insure much better. And that by itself, together with the information that's flowing into their systems, because there are spillovers, is actually leading people into a more aggressive and perhaps a more sustainable investment kind of profile. So then just to summarize here, so as we look at the results of this, it's a five-year study here, we think we have some pretty strong evidence from this structure that temporary subsidies actually can have sustained impacts. These really are real constraints. It doesn't seem to be necessary in this case to subsidize fertilizer forever, but that initial push, that sort of cheapening the cost of experimentation seems important. And indeed, Indeed, if you complement those programs with maybe some financial interventions, in our case, we use savings as a way to reduce some of the risk. You may actually get much larger effects. And again, as I mentioned, I do work on insurance, and in a couple of our projects now, we are finding that when you pull risk out of systems with insurance, farmers actually respond. We're getting 25% increases in investment rates in Mali and Ghana and a couple of other places like that. That evidence is still fairly thin. I think in the end, we've got some interesting evidence here. That doesn't mean the Mozambique program was done in the most intelligent way possible. Certainly was an interesting program, as I mentioned, and it's important to stress. Everything I showed you here was predicated on the fact that a supply infrastructure had been put out there, and the idea was to get mom and pop stores basically offering improved inputs. But that doesn't mean we couldn't do it better. So one of the issues I think that really begs for further exploration here is only 50% of the farmers who were offered the vouchers actually used them. They had to be able to co-finance them. Now, the people that actually were declared eligible were people who said they were willing to pay the $30 or so that were necessary to match the voucher subsidy, and yet most of them didn't pick it up. And we asked them, why didn't you use the voucher? They said, oh, I couldn't get the money together. So there's some thinking here about what's the right level of subsidy. I mean, if in fact we've cut in half the number of people who might have experimented, to save $30, was that actually smart? We can sort of think about that. That's not an easy question. So I think there are other issues there. And the other thing then is that, what I've shared with you are average effects. There's a lot of heterogeneity here. There's a lot of soil heterogeneity, as all you know. And that's something that Tom is going to jump forward and talk to us about. And there are a number of us. I run this BASIS Assets and Market Access Innovation Lab. We've got about three projects right now that are looking very specifically at soil quality and returns to fertilizer. And these are really complex issues, as we say. But that said, in this particular area, which sort of seems like typical low input, low productivity, sort of stuck in this particular area of Mozambique, at least these temporary subsidies seem to work. So that's my favorite picture from the project, the guy taking his fertilizer home on his bicycle. So with that, I'll pass it over to Tom, and thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to be here this morning. Thanks, Julie and Margaret, for the invitation to come here. It's always a pleasure. So let me start in with the title here. This isn't going to be a Floyd Mayweather-Pacquiao sort of boxing, because I agree that there may be a very distinct role for input subsidy programs in some contexts, in some way. But I think we're all in agreement that this is... We have a multifaceted set of problems here that are impeding not only productivity growth in Africa, but sustainable agricultural productivity growth in Africa. It's one thing to get agricultural productivity growth this year or next year. There are well-known ways to do that. But to do it in a way that can sustain productivity of this system that farmers operate in over a sustained period of time, that's the challenge. And I think that's what I'd kind of like to talk about. So just by way of introduction, let's talk a little bit about the amount of money that governments are spending on input subsidy programs. The reason why I raise this is because in many cases it's anywhere from 20 up to 70% in Malawi's case of their agricultural budgets are spent year in, year out on input subsidy programs over the past 10 years. That's a huge opportunity cost in terms of millions and millions of dollars each year that have, there's an opportunity cost about how those resources could be spent in other ways. So even if the subsidy programs were producing some benefit, the question is that benefit equal to what that money could be achieving if it were used in alternative ways? How many clinics could have been built in rural areas? How many roads could have been developed? So forth. So the opportunity cost issue here is one that we should not lose sight of. Our objectives are to, how to move from a situation where many governments realize that they're in a bind. They're importing food, a global price of food's very high. They've seen riots and what riots can do in urban areas. So there's big political risks of not getting enough food, to feed urban areas. So food production growth is a critical objective, but how do we move from a situation where subsidy programs can constitute 30, 40, 60, 70% of the national budget to agriculture to one where there's a more holistic program that takes into account the range of sustainability issues to get productivity growth? And then what would such a holistic program actually look like, you know, on the ground? So the work that I'm going to present right now draws from about three or four papers that we've worked on over the years, and I'm going to try to weave the findings of those three or four papers together. The first conclusion is that rural Africa is still experiencing fairly rapid population growth. It's the only region in the world where rural populations are continuing to rise. So the population of sub-Saharan Africa in rural areas in 2050 is going to be about 48% higher than what it is now. So sustained rural population growth. And many of the areas of Africa, not all of them, but many of the areas of Africa have reached their land frontier. So area expansion is not possible. So what's happening with population growth is fragmentation and subdivision of land. And the data shows fairly accurately and fairly clearly that over the last 10, 20 years, the farm size of most smallholder farmers has been declining. Another interesting fact to me is that 1% of Africa's rural lands contains 20% of its rural people. And 20% of Africa's rural lands contains about 82% of its entire rural population. So rural populations are highly clustered into certain areas. And that has implications for a sustainable growth strategy. One of the things we're noticing in these densely populated areas is that fallows have virtually been eliminated. And the whole system of the farming systems of most of Africa for time immemorial have been one that were shifting cultivation. So you utilize this plot of land until it's exhausted its fertility, but land is plentiful, and so then you move on to other plots and then cultivate them afterwards. So you can deal with declining soil fertility easily in that system because you just move to a different plot. But that's becoming increasingly unviable with population growth and reaching the land frontier. So the farming systems have to evolve in a way that not only sustainably plows back in nitrogen, which is, by the way, nitrogen is the primary ingredient in inorganic fertilizer. So the subsidy programs in place are primarily allowing farmers to put more nitrogen in the ground and a little bit of phosphorus too. But the productivity of the system is going to require not just nitrogen, but micronutrients. It's going to have to deal with soil organic carbon and many things that are needed to really get a response out of inorganic fertilizer. So this fallows decline is a big problem unless the farming system is able to not just replenish N, but many other things as well. Soil mining is another thing that we're seeing. The agronomists and soil scientists have been raising this red flag for a couple of decades now. So N balance is going way down. Just to show you how related this is to population growth, here's we're seeing that phosphorus does seem to be the soil content of carbon of soil and nitrogen is much lower in densely populated areas. The same thing is very true if you looked at nitrogen balances as well. So this is evidence of some soil mining. The fourth conclusion is massive soil degradation. Maybe some of you have seen this report that came out a few months ago by the Montpellier panel, which reports that about 65% of Africa's farmland is degraded, highly weathered, facing declining soil fertility, and that burden is disproportionately carried by smallholder farmers. So the red flag, I think, is starting to kind of be increasingly understood about the soil fertility dimension of a sustainable productivity growth strategy here. And the fifth conclusion is evidence of low and declining crop response rates to inorganic fertilizer. Inorganic fertilizer, by the way, is the fertilizer that you put in bags and is the stuff of input subsidy programs. Organic fertilizer is things like compost, manure. There's a lot of soil organic matter in the organic fertilizer. So evidence of declining response rates and low response rates. This is, I think, at the crux of the issue here about fertilizer and productivity. Survey after survey in recent years shows that the agronomic response rate to inorganic fertilizer is quite low. It can be as high as 20 or so in places in Kenya, but in Nigeria it's as low as 8 kilograms of maize per kilogram of nitrogen. Okay, that's not fertilizer, but that's nitrogen, the nitrogen component of the fertilizer. So the response rates to fertilizer would be about 3. That's exceedingly low. In places in Malawi, a review here by Snap et al. Shows survey after survey showing maize response to nitrogen around 7 to 12 or so. Exceedingly low. So it's hard for farmers, given the output prices for maize and the input prices for fertilizer, these response rates are generally unprofitable for farmers to turn a profit in fertilizer. If I calculate it right, Michael, your response rates are going to be about 40 or so for Mozambique, which is possible in areas where they're new to fertilizer use. These are areas that have been using fertilizer for a long time, and it tends to be, once you've used it in the plot for 5-10 years, the response rates tend to go down. So anyway, the point of this is to say that that the agronomic responses, and by the way, these are about half as much as what you see in Asia. In Bangladesh and in India and in places, the nitrogen response is in the realm of 30 to 40. That's irrigated. You can do water control. This is dry land. So the dry land part of this is a major one of the reasons why these numbers are so low. So highly variable crop response rates, too. This takes the most productive region of Zambia. It's natural region 2A. Where the maize, it's kind of the maize breadbasket of Zambia, and it looks at the response that farmers are getting to inorganic fertilizer use. The mean is about 16 kilograms of maize per kilogram of nitrogen, but you can see that some farmers are using fertilizer fairly efficiently. They're getting 30 kilograms of maize per kilogram of nitrogen, but at least a third of that sample are getting unbelievably low response rates. And what are some of the reasons for this are not just low soil fertility. It could be floods, it could be pests, it could be striga, it could be monkeys coming in at harvest time and taking the crop. There's all manner of these issues. These are some of the risks that Michael talked about that farmers need to take account of when using inorganic fertilizer. So there's multivariate constraints on the profitability of using fertilizer. We've concluded that there's 4 signs of unsustainable land intensification that are happening in much of the region. One is soil mining. And soil mining is technically defined as every time you plant a crop, it's pulling out nutrients and you're not replenishing it the next year at the same rate. So the nutrient content of that soil just increasingly gets lower and lower and lower over time. And that also constrains the crop response to inorganic fertilizer. The inadequate recycling of organic matter, and organic matter is one of the critical complements to nitrogen. So if your soil organic carbon content is too low in the soil, you may apply nitrogen fertilizer, but that soil becomes technically non-responsive to inorganic fertilizer. So the soil organic content is a major factor that will influence the economics of using inorganic fertilizer. the demise of fallows, as I've said, and then the limited profitability of using fertilizer at full market price. So partially the explanation for number four is some of these other ones, like two and three. So it's an interrelated system, and the idea of getting farmers to want to use fertilizer at the full market price will require dealing with these measures of these aspects of the system as well. So what are the factors that are depressing nitrogen use efficiency? Well, I've talked a little bit about this one. There's a very interesting study from Malawi that's going on that looks at soil samples that were taken in about five districts of Malawi 20 years ago by the FAO. And so these soil samples record all the kind of plot content, soil carbon content. And then they went back to those same areas and did 1,000 soil samples in the exact same villages and areas 20 years later. And it's very alarming. The measures of soil fertility 20 years ago were generally much higher than they are now. And agronomists and soil scientists talk about a threshold level of soil organic carbon. Many of those plots now, soil samples now, were below that threshold. So there's something very serious going on here that cannot be addressed simply by increasing nitrogen. This was done by Pascual Mareña and Chris Barrett a few years ago from Kenya. They put the plot carbon content, this is basically a measure of soil organic matter, on this axis, and then the maize yields on this axis. And as you can see, there's sort of a non-linear, but definitely a relationship between high levels of soil organic matter and yields. And then they recorded the relationship between the nitrogen response to inorganic fertilizer, and again plot content, and found the same thing, that basically the profitability of a small farmer using inorganic fertilizer is very much related to being over this a certain threshold of plot content. In many areas of sub-Saharan Africa where soil testing has been done, maybe about half, a third to a half of all of the smallholder farmers are in this range, somewhere below about 1.5 to 2. And this is the level that's required for profitable use if you use a VCR measure of about 2. So a serious issue. Acidification, I haven't even talked about that. This is a big problem in parts of West Africa, northern Zambia, increasingly western Kenya. Acidification is measured by the pH of the soil. And once you get below about 4.8 or so pH level, the phosphorus has trouble being absorbed by the plant. So you can apply the basal fertilizer at planting time. The phosphorus really won't do you much good in acidic soils. So here is a plot from Mississippi. Everything on this plot is exactly the same, except for this one received two or three helpings of lime, and lime is what you put to reduce the acidification problem. And you can see pretty dramatic differences. These are the pH levels here. Acidic soil, a little bit ameliorated soil after liming, pretty big difference. And then here's this picture is from Zambia, same thing. These two plots are exactly the same in every way, except this one got a big dose of lime the previous year. This one did not. So northern Zambia has a major problem with acidification. Third one, micronutrient deficiencies. This has been discovered in Ethiopia. I don't know, for those of you that are familiar with kind of the Ethiopian story, there's some interesting work that the ATA is doing, the Agricultural Transformation Authority. And apparently they've done soil mapping in Ethiopia and have found that boron and zinc were two of the limiting factors that inhibit the response of inorganic fertilizer. So apparently there's been additions of zinc and boron to fertilizer mix in Ethiopia, and boom, there's this big increase in the response rates that farmers are getting nowadays in Ethiopia. So in some cases, micronutrient deficiencies are pretty important. So everybody agrees, almost everybody agrees, that inorganic fertilizer use has to go up. It's exceedingly low. In any kind of sustainable intensification strategy, it's hard to envision how African farmers are going to, you know, be internationally competitive or anything close to it unless massive increases in inorganic fertilizer. So I think we're all agreed here. Why isn't it happening? There's this sort of cycle that we think is happening that's exacerbated by land pressures and reduced fallows, increased fertilizer use, but increasing fertilizer use on soil that's not going to give farmers a good response. As a result of these deficiencies in the soil, it leads to low crop response rates to nitrogen and then depressed profitability. So the solution has to be how to get the response rates up enough, dramatically up enough, so that year after year after year, farmers are going to be able to use fertilizer in a profitable way. Right now in Zambia, this is maybe not the best way to show it, but it shows that 37% of Zambian farmers cannot use top dressing, that's urea, profitably, but about 93% of Zambia's farm population doesn't seem to be using basal application profitably right now. So no wonder use rates are extremely low unless they're subsidized. So I've talked about some of these reasons. I'm going to kind of go through the litany now of various factors that are reducing nitrogen response. Soil moisture. By the way, do you know that in areas where soil organic carbon is quite high, it contains about 2,000 tons more water in that soil than the same hectare of land that doesn't have very much soil organic content? Because that carbon is like a sponge. It holds water. So it allows, it's actually insurance against drought. So the soil organic matter tends to have all these desirable properties that interact well with inorganic fertilizer. Sig Snap, a colleague of mine at Michigan State, she's an agronomist. Some of her work points out that the ability of farmers to use fertilizer efficiently is crucially dependent on weeding. Something as mundane as weeding. If you're not weeding and getting those weeds out of there, the weeds tend to compete for the nitrogen with the maize stalk. So weeding is and there's many reasons why farmers have problems with weeding intensively. Crop rotation, I won't go into that because I'm kind of getting short on time. My bottom line is that there seems to be a problem with nitrogen fixation, and I'm not talking about legumes that fix nitrogen in the soil. I'm talking about people who are fixated with one nutrient when it's a multivaried, you know, set of constraints here that need to be addressed to get the sustainable part of this. So our conclusion is that input subsidy programs need to be a part of a more holistic approach that can make nitrogen use profitable. Okay, I'm limited on time, so let me just go to elements of what a holistic strategy would look like. So the first one is R&D, and public sector R&D is in a sorry state in many countries. They're way underfunded. I'm going to show you a picture of what Zambia's soil chemistry lab looks like in a minute. Extension programs, how to scale up. There's a knowledge issue. How to scale up in a way that farmers can actually be reached. Many extension programs in Africa are virtually defunct. Extension agents don't have the way to get out there. They have no petrol in their in motorcycles. There's just not the kind of education programs to reach farmers. And these programs are crucial to complement increased inorganic fertilizer use. Conservation agriculture, we believe there's great potential in conservation agriculture, but there's also low adoption right now. Farmers are not adopting conservation agricultural practices at the rate that we would expect them to. There's problems with those that need to be kind of retrofitted a bit. Physical infrastructure, getting the cost of the inputs to farmers down. Interesting study from Ethiopia shows that, you know, over half of the cost that farmers in remote areas of Ethiopia pay for fertilizer are the costs after they enter the country. It's not the cost of production. It's not the cost of international transport. Not the, you know, clearing it out of the port. It's what happens getting it to the farmers once it's in Ethiopia. So reducing the costs in these input supply chains. And then lastly, more appropriate fertilizer use recommendations. Many of the recommendations that public sector gives to farmers about how much fertilizer to use are based on trials. They're not based on actual smallholder conditions. So they tend to greatly overestimate, you know, use 400 kilograms of fertilizer per hectare. That's way too high compared to what smallholder farmers are going to be able to use profitably, given the constraints that they face. So one of the often asked policy questions is, you know, how to be less negative. This debate about fertilizer subsidies has been going on for a long time. People have asked me, you know, if you're saying this isn't the right way to go, well, what is? What's the right way? Concrete guidance to improve their effectiveness. So we have three proposals. One is try to complement subsidy programs with the other holistic elements that I talked about a moment ago, you know, five or six things that could make input subsidy programs more profitable for farmers. Second issue is to target poor farmers to achieve more equitable outcomes. I'm going to talk about number two real briefly, and then the political will issue. So the first one was get the other complementary parts of the system in place. To allow subsidy programs to earn a payoff for farmers. I've talked a little bit about those, the extension, the R&D programs to, you know, get soil organic carbon more in the system. The second one is reconsidering the targeting guidelines. Here's a case for Zambia. Nationally representative survey, this is about 14,000 households. You see that most of the farmers, 41%, are between 0 and 1 hectare of land. They're certainly the poorest. Between these first two categories, about 75% of the farmers have less than 2 hectares of land. But look at how the subsidy programs are allocating fertilizer. By far, the biggest recipients are the ones that, you know, this 3% of farmers down here who are operating 10 to 20 hectares of land. There's a political economy here, and when you can control, you know, in an experiment who the recipients are, you know, you don't have to worry about that. But then when you get into the messy world of actually, you know, allocating public funds to recipients, that's where the political economy challenges come in, and many of the benefits do end up getting, let's say diverted. Another issue here is we found that about 1/3 of all of the fertilizer going through the subsidy programs in Malawi and in Zambia end up getting diverted by government, somebody in the middle. And the way we were, Q&A if you want to know how we, you know, established that. But when 1/3 of $200 million gets diverted in the middle, that's a huge problem that's going to reduce the cost effectiveness of this program from the standpoint of the recipients, who are supposed to be the smallholder, you know, farmers. So our third proposal about subsidy programs is, can there be greater political will at the top to root out corruption? These programs are vulnerable to corruption. So to make them operate better, we certainly need a little more will at the top to make them operate better. This is a ranking of alternative investments based on kind of a meta study of Asia, 7 or 8 countries in Asia. And here are the various public sector strategies or investments. And I've ranked them for you. The Economist comes up with policy environment, enabling environment is number one, agricultural R&D, investment, number two and three. Input subsidies is somewhere near the bottom of the economist list in terms of the contributions to agricultural growth. IFPRI's study is only from India, but there's a very similar ranking there. And then we also ranked it with respect to poverty reduction. So if the goal is poverty reduction, once again, fertilizer subsidies don't end up looking too good on the list of overall investments. So that harks back to the first graph that I put up showing, you know, $200 million a year going to input subsidy programs and the opportunity costs involved. So this doesn't say that the results that Michael presented, you know, are not right. I believe them totally. But when you get to kind of the messy reality of implementation and trying to integrate these into public sector programs, there's a lot of things that need to be factored in. My main message is that this third one, that spending a large share of the ag budget on input subsidy programs may not be the most effective way to go, given the payoffs to other things. Certainly a demonstrable way to show your constituents that you're doing something. They're very visible, they're very politically desirable. This is my main message, that subsidy programs would certainly be more effective if more of the budgets were allocated to the complementary public investments that are required to make input subsidy programs more effective for farmers. Those complementary public investments would be extension programs. But in order for extension programs to be effective, they have to be based on good science so that extension agents are extending the right messages and working with farmers in the right way. That's public R&D. And there's a lot of problems with the public R&D system right now, and that should be one of, I think, our greatest entry points in FTF and CADIP programs and things like that, to revivify what the messages ought to be going through the extension programs. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.